Hi, I'm Ruthie, and I have a recorder. Tune in Wednesdays from 4 to 5 to Out There. We'll meet people and plants around the streets and paths of Northampton, and we'll think about ways we can share the world. Here on Valley Free Radio, or archived online at weatherbeer.com/out there. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in. We don't care if they laugh at us. Let them take the bus and leave the sickle for us. They can have a Cadillac and T-Bud too. But give me my rocket bicycle for two. So, Evie, how was Pride Parade on Sunday?
It was great, and then we went to the fairgrounds afterwards, which was also fun. We ran into two police officers, the Northampton Police, and
have some fun with them, and we asked them if they were together and where they got those really authentic, cute police officer outfits.
Was it you guys?
Yeah. And They were cordial and said that they actually had to enter into a lottery to win the privilege of being on Pride Patrol.
Oh, wow.
To work Pride, because it's such a good gig, apparently. And one of them said that he was the police station liaison for LGBT... Like, he's the point person for LGBT hate crimes. And I said, oh, that's really great to know. Like, what's your name? And I looked at his badge, and it said Beaver. And I was like, Beaver? And he was like, yes, yes. And I was like, really? And then he gave me his card. And it was actually said Officer Beaver across the top. And I was like, I stood there dumbfounded. Like, your name is Officer Beaver, and you're the... LGBT guy. Awesome.
So, Officer Beaver would like to know of any issues that anyone is having around LGBT hate crimes.
I wonder if you could, just tell me your poke recipe and how you cook and how to fix it.
You break the leaves off, mm-hmm. and you put it in a kettle of water, mm-hmm. and you cook it till it's all wilted, and it goes down to nothing almost.
Like an hour or two?
No. Just about 20 minutes for it to wilt down and cook. Uh-huh. And then you get it out of there and drain the water off of it.
Uh-huh.
And if you just got about a pint or uh-huh. a quart, you put you some shortening or bacon grease uh-huh. in your pan. And about 3 eggs. Knock them up and pour them in that, mix it up, and salt,
uh-huh.
and let it fry. The eggs get done, and then you just, you know, just stir it up. Good.
There you have it.
You've never had any?
I had some at my friend's house, but I was telling Clifford, I don't really cook many things, so I have to change the water because I'm too lazy.
Poke salad is easy
yeah.
because you just wash it and put it in the... I put it in an electric skillet out here with a tall lid so you won't smell it in the house so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just lift it out of that skillet and take it in, and it's ready to put in the frying pan.
Mm-hmm. And then do you freeze stuff for later?
Oh, yeah, you can freeze it. If you're going to freeze it, you just take it out of where you've wilted it down and cooked it.
Mm-hmm.
Drain the water out of it and put it in freezer bags. And then when you take it out, you just let it thaw out. Mix you some eggs in with it.
Right.
That's easy.
All right, I'm gonna have to try it, because the other person I talked to said you got to boil it for like an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Oh, no.
Like, that's a long time. I'm not going to. Yeah.
Just you don't. See, he picked a garbage sack full, and I made about 7 small bags for the freezer.
Yeah.
Have a garbage bag full. So.
All right.
Then you take those stalks.
Uh-huh.
About this tall. You pull them leaves off.
Then you pull all that bark off of them.
Uh-huh.
And fry them like okra. Man, oh, they're delicious, them stalks.
Good thing, it's not too hard to find, pokeweed.
Yeah.
Did you just harvest them up in the hills,
yeah,
in the woods?
Yeah, up here where they made those roads. Anywhere they, like in the mountains, anywhere they, like a log road or a new road, and then the poke, it comes up. It gets the seeds up close enough where they'll germinate.
What do you think's ideal size, height?
Probably the best, about 6 inches high. Or if it's big, tall, the main top of it is real tender. No, it right now it's time to get it.
Yeah.
You know, when it gets real old, you don't get it.
Yeah.
It'd be tough if you leave it in there.
Well, it'd be poison bad. It is poison if you don't cook it right.
Yeah, my friend was saying that some work campers came up and were excited about poke, and they ate some, but they didn't cook it right, and they all had to go to the hospital.
They done it like my onions over here and that lettuce.
Uh-huh.
You can pick it and chop it up, and then we fry bacon, and then that hot bacon grease.
Yeah.
That's the way they done that poke, and it didn't. They had to go to the hospital.
You heard about that?
Yeah. You don't do it like that. You got to cook it down.
Boil it. Boil the toxins out.
If you want to make your tea out of that root, you better find out how to do it, because it is poison.
All right, I'm not gonna drink it if I don't know what it is.
They used to boil that poke root and soak their corn like it's gonna plant.
Uh-huh.
Because there were so many ground squirrels, and then the ground squirrels eat that here, kill them.
Oof.
It's that poke, buddy.
Huh.
Back down this way. It should be up here. Some places ain't up here.
Where's Ivy's up?
Yeah.
Mommy.
There ain't nothing up there.
It grows beside a briar, usually.
Your mom would cook it?
Yeah. Yeah, she's cooked it ever since I've been little. We'd come home from school and Tammy would take the awfulest fit. Because it does stink when you cook it. It does smell really bad.
Uh-huh.
And she would tell Mom, she's like, why do you have to fix that? It smells so bad. Me and Mom and Dad were the only ones that would eat it.
Uh-huh.
Tammy wouldn't touch it. I don't think she's ever tasted it.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, how do you not like something if you've never tasted it?
Huh, she just couldn't get over the smell.
Yeah, she just couldn't get over the smell. And I mean, once you start cooking it, it does smell really bad. It will give a skunk a run for its money. But I mean, after that, after you cook it down, you can't smell it anymore. Once it starts frying, it smells delicious.
Yeah.
And then you get a big frying pan,
mm-hmm,
and you put shortening in it, mm-hmm, like half a cup shortening.
Lard.
Lard and any kind of oil, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then you drain it off, you let it fry for about 15-20 minutes. Then you add 4 to 5 eggs to it.
Uh-huh.
You stir the eggs up in the poke and let it fry for a little while longer. Then you add meal to it.
Uh-huh. Like cornmeal?
Cornmeal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you stir all that up together, you level it out, and you let it brown on the bottom. Then you flip it over, mm-hmm, and let it brown on the top. Then you stir it up and let it mush it back down,
mm-hmm,
and let it fry again until it's brown all the way around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you fix cornbread or beans or something like that, and you eat with it.
It sounds like you have an in-depth knowledge of this meal.
I have cooked it since I've been about 13 years old.
Mm. So, boiling it for like an hour and a half, 2 hours.
You have to let it cook it long enough for it get, it's so bitter you can't eat it.
Uh-huh.
And if it's bitter, that means the poison's not out of it yet.
What's left nutritionally after you cooked it for that long? You know?
I don't know if there's anything left nutritionally or not. It just tastes good.
All right. Is it still green by the time you get done cooking it?
Yeah. Yeah, it turns a dark, deep green when you cook it.
Mm. So right now you're preserving some?
Yeah, we're putting it in freezer bags and freezing it for wintertime. Because Bobby wants it in wintertime, too.
Mm-hmm.
And usually around 1st of June, middle of June, something like that, when green tomatoes comes in, I get green tomatoes and I fry them with poke and beans, green onions, stuff like that. And, I mean, that's like our Thanksgiving dinner.
That sounds good.
It is good.
Hi, I'm Violet Bertelson, a local herbalist, and this and every Saturday, I am having an herb walk and walks at Northampton, Toucan Street, right by the bike path in Frogtown, where the bike path is close to the parking lot outside of Acadia Herbals. We'll be looking at the seasonal herbs, discussing their uses, their properties, and their magic. So please come and join us this Saturday and every Saturday at 2 p.m.
I found a bike today. It looks so good, why did you throw it away?
You want to learn to fix your bike? How to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it? Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Venga para el Bike Lab de Northampton y se divertirá mucho, le enseñará muchas lecciones como arreglar bicicletas.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue,
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
Ya súbase a la bici, compa. Trépese a la de montaña, la bici urbana, la bici cross. Lléguele a la bicicleta. Ya de menos a la eléctrica o a la estática, ya no hay tos. Llegaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá para acá.
Yes, Dwayne?
Yeah, we use grease at the bike lab, but not bacon grease. But, you know, I was just thinking that if you took and, like, repacked someone's hub with bacon grease, they'd have all the neighborhood dogs, like, chasing them down the street and pedal really fast.
Remind me not to do that.
We use regular grease. I have bacon grease stuck in my head all day.
Yeah, but bacon grease, would at least it wouldn't be a fossil fuel petroleum product.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to get to the interview with Clifford about coal mining. And, oh gosh. I told you this would be technologically difficult.
I got my sign.
Oh, yeah. Tell about the Adopt-A Trail.
Yes. Last year, how many years ago did the Pedal People, like, Adopt-A Trail?
Yes.
Yeah, like, so two?
Yeah, the whole Adopt-A Trail program for the rail trail between, like, Northampton and East Hampton, Florence, started, I think, 2 years ago.
Yeah. So we all went out and did a nice the section from the Nurse Street Bridge down by Taco Bell, you know, that whole section. It gets a lot of debris.
Yeah, like the trash.
Cars just like all blown across this huge parking lot. And then
blows from King Street across this parking lot, so gets caught by the fence right up against the rail trail every day.
I don't think the nip bottles go that far, but yeah, so it's, you asked me last year to take and start mowing it. And
what a guy.
It's great, but last year, the grass down by Taco Bell was just out of control. It was like 2 feet high, and there's no way you're going to mow it. But this year, I got to jump on it.
Very good.
And I was clipping along on the section of the bike route yesterday. I was done, and I was going to head home, and I seen this guy on a skateboard, and he had, like, all these signs.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, oh, you got signs? I said, is my sign in there?
Uh-huh.
He's like, well, I don't know. He goes, actually, it's the next one I have to put up. Finally.
You got your sign.
Yeah.
You've been mowing that grass for a year.
But even on a sign, I'm a Pedal People sub. I'm next in line.
What's the sign say?
This is sponsored by Pedal People and Dwayne Rainey.
All right. Yeah, the the grass that Dwayne's been mowing along the rail trail, it's not cut by the city or anything.
No.
Whereas the other stretch, like from Stop and Shop up to Look Park, that's city maintenance. But this other part, the cutting is all volunteer
and,
done.
And it's really cool because and the section before, from the Main Street Bridge to North Street Bridge, is maintained by this guy who owns A to Z, Jack.
Jack Finn.
Yeah, and he lets me use his lawnmower.
Nice.
So when vegetables come in, I kind of shove some his way. He appreciates it.
Very nice. All right. Again, if you just tuned in, this is Out There on Valley Free Radio. And the next clip I have is from Clifford Maiden. He is a friend and neighbor from Bell County, Kentucky, where I'm from. I was hanging out with him and his wife while the kids were playing a few weeks ago when I was in Kentucky. And I asked him a bit about his experience.
I wonder if I could ask you a few questions about your experience working in the mines and the changes you've seen in like the coal industry and what you think about what direction things are heading in. When did you work?
I started to work in 65 and worked 95.
What did you do exactly?
I drove a shell car in the mines.
Mm-hmm. Underground.
A continuous miner, a joy loader. It changed a lot since I first started going in there. You know, they had more machinery. Had a what they call a cutting machine that cut back in the coal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you drill holes and use dynamite to blast it down. And then that joy loader had these arms on it, worked like this.
Uh-huh.
And loaded it out on a conveyor into a car. It was in 65. Probably in 70, they went for what they call a continuous miner. It dug the coal out. Got big augers on it and bits in it. And turned like this. Load down. And it still had that loader in there getting it and loading it out.
So with a continuous miner, then there weren't people in there? Did they just, the machine just pulled it out? There were people in there too?
Yeah, there's people all the time.
Okay.
And then they went from that continuous. They didn't do away with it. It had to drive entries up. You know, it would drive, that's called an entry in a mine, to drive up way up this way.
Uh-huh.
Over here, drive up this way. Then they cut together here. Uh-huh. You had this big block of coal.
Uh-huh.
Now, that would be a long ways. Then they had what's called a long wall miner.
Mm-hmm.
It set up back here. Had these big hydraulic jacks that went up again the roof, to hold the roof up. And that head went all the way up and down this block like this, loading coal out.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought that whole block out.
So after this block is moved out, like I imagine, like the people are coming out, are you moving all your equipment out? Like, does it collapse?
Come out, yeah.
It's going to collapse. You're trying to make sure.
It collapses as you're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, you got these big hydraulic jacks right here, and you're working right here. And when you cut down, it'll cut down 3 or 4 feet at a time down that wall. And then when you move them down, this falls in.
Uh-huh.
All that rock.
Uh-huh. And that sounds terrifying to me.
Well, it's not when you get used to it.
Uh-huh.
It's not. It's just like going to work in a factory or something.
Yeah.
I mean, the conditions are different, but you don't pay any attention to it.
Yeah.
A coal miner is a lot closer. You get a lot closer in there than you do. You know, you take care of your buddy and he take care of you. Mm-hmm. That's the only way you can survive in the mines. Somebody got to watch for you. Four eyes is better than two. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty safe.
Mm-hmm. But
the administration we got now, they want to get away from coal. They made it so hard on the coal plants that they couldn't meet the standards, and they just had to shut down. So if they shut down and you can't see any coal, then that shuts down.
In terms of moving away from the underground mining, did you do the underground mining? Like, was that happening up until 95?
Yeah.
Because like, I know.
On past that, that's when I retired out.
Yeah, okay.
It really boomed up until, about when the Obama administration went in, you know, and that EPA, then it started declining.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the strip mining versus the mountaintop removal.
I don't like that mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
The strip mine, you know, the way the laws that they had to start, they done pretty good, you know. Mm-hmm. They reclaimed good and fixed it mm-hmm. back at the slope it was at. Yeah.
So what's the difference between the underground mine versus the strip mine versus the mountaintop removal?
Well, that underground, it goes in the mountain.
Yeah, you just...
In there.
And then the only
disturbance on that mountain is...
Yeah.
You know, out here.
Keep the topsoil, keep the trees.
Yeah,
so
you don't do anything with that. The strip mines, when it gets that seam of coal, it'll go around and they take it all the timber and then they move that dirt. They can't mm-hmm. just push it over like they used to. And then when they get the coal out, they reclaim it and put mm-hmm. it right back up here to where, if they take it as high, that's called a high wall up here.
Uh-huh.
You have to cut so deep on that mountain to get down to the coal.
Uh-huh.
They get back down to the coal, and then they load that out. And if that high wall's 100 feet high, they got to store that dirt. And then when they get reclaiming, they put it right back the way it was. I mean, it's not quite near what it was, but eventually.
Compared to a mountaintop removal, it's
400 or 500 years it will be.
Uh-huh.
And then the mountaintop remover, they just take the whole mountain. Top, from the seam to the top.
Yeah.
They take that whole top of that mountain down to the seam of coal.
Do you know what they're doing over on Fondy or somewhere?
That's a strip, just a strip mine.
Uh-huh.
If they could just do underground mining, of course, I'm an underground miner now, I'd be a little bit prejudiced, you'd see they have to be buildings uh-huh. and a place to set your temple. But uh-huh. the mountain is not not like that.
Yeah.
If you take all that coal out on that mountain, it won't just sit down that much. It falls in the area, but it falls and it blocks itself out.
Uh-huh.
It don't just fall from the top down.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know it was.
Yeah, if you take out a rock from the bottom of a rock pile, things sort of fill in. It's not
on
like
Tackett Creek, where I worked 20-some years. Uh-huh. Right now, and you could never tell there's a mines there.
Huh. Uh-huh.
The deep mines, you can't even tell it.
Yeah. So why did they switch to doing?
It's cheaper, less men.
Yeah. I was reading.
I'm for clean water and all that stuff. And they did do a good job on that mm-hmm. after the laws, But now when you get in her area. You're taking my livelihood away, mm-hmm. with some regulations that I don't know about.
Yeah, it's really complicated.
Yeah,
issue.
And I know they had the technology, but they didn't have the money. The companies didn't have the money to put them scrubbers on them power plants to get that sulfur out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But our government did. I mean, mm-hmm. they got enough to send over to countries that hate their guts.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm a coal miner, I believe they got just a little bit out of line. I believe when you take good, hard-working men and women, and they're making real good money and put them out on a soup mm-hmm. line, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
When you could fix that, put that scrubber on them.
Yeah.
If that sulfur is what they're doing, they got technology to get that out.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah.
See, we mine coal over there in the Georgia Power. If the sulfur, they monitored all that out there in the tipple. If it got 2%, then they didn't want that coal.
Uh-huh. Sulfur.
That area of that mine, we just stopped mining that. Huh. And, it was sulfur, and that mine's run. Some places there was none, and some there was. I don't know all about that.
Yeah.
They monitored it. And sometimes it got so bad you could see it in the coal. You could see it.
Wow. Like the sulfur content.
Yeah.
What did it look like? Like yellow?
Yellow.
Yeah. So what do you think is a best case scenario for the coal and the coal industry? Like the money is invested on putting the scrubbers that clean it well. And then what about in terms of the way mining is done? Like strip mining versus mountaintop removal, underground mining? How do you think?
Well, on the mountaintop, I'm not for that at all. Mm-hmm. I love mountains.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I live here.
I can do that, but I'm a deep mine.
Mm-hmm.
There will be no that much damage. Mm-hmm. You've got to have an asset road
mm-hmm.
and a railroad,
mm-hmm.
which is not much.
Mm-hmm.
when they fix them railroads and the asset road, it's just like that road over there. Mm-hmm. It does take away some trees and stuff, but you got to live, buddy.
Yeah. I was reading that, you know, part of the reason for the decline of the coal industry is because of the cheap gas from fracking. Like, how would you compare the environmental impacts of, like, fracking versus coal mining?
I'd say that was probably one of the, I'd say at least 50, maybe 60%. It wasn't all on the EPA, but you combine both of those and you've got a problem with coal mining. Mm-hmm. They just can't afford it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you got regulations that you absolutely can't afford, and I never could understand why our government wouldn't, you know, do that.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not on free, but let them pay so much royalty or something and pay it off.
Yeah.
To get them scrubbers and them seams of coal. There's some seams of coal that don't have hardly any. Though that Western coal don't have hardly any
sulfur,
but it don't have no BTUs, and they got to mix it with this Eastern coal for it to burn. Mm-hmm. You got to have so much heat around a power plant.
Maybe they should put some more regulations on fracking.
Yeah, I don't know about that fracking now. It couldn't be good. There's no way it could be good. But now the coal is. They've took us Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia and Southern Ohio, and these people's in poverty now.
Mm-hmm.
And they got the technology. See, that's another thing on this water, coal industry, and they can't pollute this water like it's oil and gas do. They, you know, you can't just get in that creek and with coal mining and logging neither one. But gas, oil, they do.
Wait, what do you mean?
They'll pollute that stream, you know that.
You mean the runoff?
Yeah.
Whatever they're doing?
And you can't do that on the in coal mining. You not even on the asset road that we had coming into the mines, they couldn't do it.
Just because it was better maintained or what? Yeah. You mean because of regulations?
Yeah. And good regulations. Uh-huh. You know, they fixed it where it wasn't. It had a runoff, but it had sediment ponds, you know, and it caught that runoff on that road.
But you're saying
they don't.
With the gas and oil drilling, there's none of those regulations. They just doze.
They don't even have them.
They just doze some road any which way, willy-nilly up the mountain and just let it wash out.
So if you don't have any regulations, and I do believe in them, especially on the water and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I believe in keeping that water clean because without it, you're in trouble. You know, and I don't know how you feel, and that don't bother me about it, but I don't believe in global warming.
Uh-huh.
If today, say it's 100 degrees today, well, they can go back way back, and it was 100 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me, I don't know how they know, but they, I guess they do, that before there's any industry, before there's any automobiles, coal, or anything, they had a meltdown in the ice age, you know. So I really don't, you know, I don't know where they just, Al Gore's got rich or what.
Uh-huh.
I don't, you know, I don't believe in global warming.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it may be hot this summer and it may be cold, I don't know. But I do know I've lived long enough to know what weather does. Seem like it runs in a cycle. But on the coal mining part, you know, I never could understand that why the government didn't put scrubbers and stuff in to keep these coal mines running.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I was playing an interview with Clifford Maiden from Frakes, Kentucky. He's a friend and neighbor. That's where my family lives. And I was down there in April visiting. And, he's a retired underground coal miner. There's also an article from The Week. Well, The Week magazine is actually they compile articles from national and international media. And this, the article, this is from April 29th, 2016, talking about the swift demise of big coal. I want to read a little bit of this article. Part of it's taken from Vox.com, an article by Brad Plummer, who says that the U.S. coal industry is imploding. Peabody Energy, the world's largest private producer of coal, last week, that's back in April, became the fifth American coal company to declare bankruptcy in the past year amid a seismic shift in the energy landscape. A decade ago, coal provided fully half of America's electricity, and today it's less than a third, which is the result of tougher regulations and a flood of cheap natural gas from fracking. But St. Louis-based Peabody, founded in 1883, was brought low by its own missteps, too. In 2011, the company made a disastrous bet on Chinese coal demand, just as China's economic growth was beginning to wane. And saddled with debt, Peabody executives insisted the market for coal would rebound, but it never did. The company, valued at $20 billion in 2011, is now worth just $38 million. $20 billion to $38 million. Wow. So that's a lot of coal companies, they're market values are plummeting like that. And natural gas, this is from an article in Slate, that natural gas now accounts for 31% of electricity produced in the United States, up from 21% in 2007. And the shift is being accelerated by regulations that discourage companies from building new coal-fired plants. Many states also now dictate that a certain amount of power come from renewable sources. And virtually every utility in the United States has contingency plans for stricter emission standards that could come down the road. Let's see. It's since 2009, I think, when the Obama White House administration put in stricter emission standards for coal. 31,000 coal miners, truckers, engineers, construction workers, and others have lost jobs in mining communities, especially in Wyoming, Pennsylvania, and Illinois. And according to Stephen Moore of the Washington Times, he says, what's maddening about all of this is that coal is much cleaner than ever before. U.S. plants have reduced their emissions by 50 to 90% over the past several decades, thanks to technologies that capture CO2 and store it underground. There's Richard Martin from technologyreview.com says that Peabody's failure actually shows the limits of clean coal technology. The coal industry has invested billions in clean coal R&D worldwide with little to show for it. Carbon capture still adds 30 to 40% to the costs of generating coal power, which is it's a non-starter if it's to be competitive with inexpensive natural gas. And Tom Sancillo and David Schlissel in the New York Times say that coal's dirty legacy will outlive the industry itself because abandoned mines create long lingering problems, including polluted drinking water. By law, coal companies are required to clean up after mining. But with bankruptcies mounting, hundreds of millions of dollars in reclamation guarantees are now in limbo. Big coal's demise means taxpayers will be stuck with cleanup bills for years to come. And that's that. Yeah. One of the things that Clifford was talking about in terms of the water and runoff and stuff, I think he was thinking more about roads, the access roads, going to the mines, in going to the oil wells, because Clifford and my family both live on the same mountainside, a few miles apart, and in that area, there's a sudden onslaught of gas and oil wells, some of them fracking, and the gas and oil companies just doze roads right up the mountain, and when it rains, the streams all turn brown, and I was asking Clifford how they get their trucks up the mountain, because with some of the wells, they have pipes that just pipe it down to the main road. And then with other wells, they go up there with trucks and haul it out. And it's like, how do you get a truck up a mountain, a muddy mountain road that steep? And Clifford said that they take the bulldozers and drag the trucks up. So I think with the gas and oil wells and that water pollution, it's a little more personal than some of the mines on the other side of the mountain, because those wells are on our side of the mountain. Anyway, yay. Thanks for tuning in out there on Valley Free Radio. I'm going to play next something. Also, on May 18th, It's going to be a walk bike public forum. It's part of a series that the city's doing, considering redesign of the streets in town. This is going to be May 18th at 5:30 p.m. at the First Church's Sanctuary in downtown Northampton. It's a presentation of recommendations for new policies, programs, and infrastructure projects to improve the environment for pedestrians and cyclists. It says open house from 5:30 to 6:30. Oh, that's why the event goes from 5:30 to 8, because the 5:30 to 6:30 is the open house. I guess probably where you can look at the proposed designs and stuff like that. All right, so next I'm going to play a little clip from this guy I met when I was coming back from the South. I ended up being in Nashville, Tennessee, getting on the megabus and scootered up to where the bus was stopped. And there's this guy on the sidewalk, and I looked at him, and he looked at me. He didn't ring a bell to me. I didn't think I'd ever seen the guy before. And then I took a seat on the bus, and then he came in because he was sitting right across the aisle, and he comes up to me, and he's like, "Do you live in Northampton?" And I was like, "Yes," thinking there's no way I know this person. I've never seen you before in my life. And he says, "Are you part of Pedal People?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, because I stayed in your house in 2002 when I was biking with a group of climate summer cyclists riding across Massachusetts." I was like, "Oh, awesome." And he said, "Let me tell you what I'm doing now." And so he told me he's working on a project called Bike the Line along a pipeline in Michigan. And right before I play this clip, it's like a 5-minute clip, I want to also mention, since I was gone when it happened, when Kinder Morgan withdrew their proposal for the NED, Tennessee Gas NED pipeline through Western Massachusetts. Woohoo! Big victory. All right. This is Murtaza.
Hi, my name is Murtaza Nek. Folks know me as Chalk around where I organize in Detroit. I'm part of a group called the Michigan Coalition Against Tar Sands, and we're collectively organizing a bike ride along a crude oil pipeline known as Line 5, owned and operated by Enbridge. The goal of the bike trip is to it's not merely a bike trip. We're actually canvassing all the communities along the route of the pipeline. We estimate there are up to 900 homes that are in the immediate vicinity of the pipeline. It's a 750-mile stretch, and the reason we're concerned about it is that it's 63 years old, it's leaked over a dozen times in the past, and most critically, it has a 4.5-mile section running through the Great Lakes, through the Straits of Mackinac. It's the Straits of Mackinac and the Great Lakes are like the largest body of fresh water, unpolluted fresh water on the planet. This pipeline is well overdue, well past its expiration date. It was built to last approximately 50 years, and it's 63-year-old now. It's still running. Enbridge wants to run it indefinitely, they've said, even now. And Enbridge is also like a not really trustworthy company. They are responsible for the largest inland tar sands disaster in U.S. history, which a lot of people didn't know about because it was happening in the summer of 2010 when the BP disaster was happening, so it was overshadowed by the BP media. Over 1 million gallons of diluted tar sands bitumen spilled into Talmadge Creek in the Kalamazoo River, and it was impossible to clean up because tar sands actually sinks in water, whereas crude oil generally floats. Line 5, which we're targeting, is a crude oil pipeline, but it's owned and operated by the same company, and so we're looking to get it shut down. There's a big environmental movement in Michigan ready to shut this down and has been already doing a whole mess of different things, but our group, Mike Katz, thinks it's time for us to reach out to the community members that actually live along the pipeline and add their voices to opposition. We assume they'd be opposed to it.
Can you just say again, how long is the pipeline? How long is the bike ride that you're focusing on?
The bike ride, the pipeline runs 750 miles from Sarnia, Ontario, to Superior, Wisconsin, all through Michigan. And the bike trip is going to be, it's going to be in two parts. The first part's 11 days from May 25th to June 4th, and the second part's going to be like 40-something days, starting July 7th and ending in August 20th. We're going to be doing events along the way. If you're interested more info, you can go to biketheline.org. There's also a Facebook page and a donation page you can access from there. We're looking for all kinds of support, not necessarily monetary. But yeah, if you could just spread the word, that would be great.
If you could spread the word. Anything else you want to add?
I'm hearing that lots of great work was done in terms of reaching out to community for the Tennessee Gas Pipeline and that it was recently shut down. So I feel like just reaching out to community members that are affected by a proposed or existing pipeline is just a really good way to go. And probably a good vibe checker for how likely the pipeline is going to be shut down. Yeah, but we think that the Line 5 is going to be shut down pretty soon because there's a lot of mainstream opposition to it already as it is now. A lot of political leaders are stepping up to propose legislation to shut it down. People are speaking up. It's great. I almost wonder whether or not this bike trip is even necessary, but we think it's going to add a lot. So.
Cool. Thanks for your work.
So you're saying that some of your family have told you that if you slow down your lifestyle whatever too much, you won't be effective. What do you think about that?
No, yeah. So actually it was the implication I got from climate organizers earlier when I was like burning a lot more fuel to just sustain my living. If you go too far in terms of like primitivizing your life and slowing down and reducing your dependence on fossil fuels and other fuels, that you'll limit your ability to actually take on and fossil fuel energy projects and like change the system and push for revolution and stuff. And I found that like pushing for sustainability was in your own life was a really important aspect of not being like kind of a hypocrite and stuff. And I also wanted to test whether or not I found that it actually is possible and very viable to both like primitivize yourself and like reduce your dependence on fuel and live more simply. I'm living off the grid right now while at the same time taking on multinational energy corporations who are involved in fossil fuel projects. I feel like I'm doing more now to fight fossil fuels than I might have in a really long time, and I'm doing it like essentially off the grid. So I do think it's viable.
Are you doing internet?
I do use the internet actually, so I don't want to come off as completely off the grid. I spend a lot of time in coffee shops, so there's my continuing hypocrisy, but it's only at the coffee shops. When I go back home, like, I'm off electricity, heat, and water grids.
In Detroit?
Yeah. I found it to be pretty viable for the most part, but going forward, I would have to figure out ways to increase my solar panel throughput for electricity and figure out ways to connect to the internet without, depending on coffee shops, but even still, the internet is a whole network of people who are all mostly connected to fossil fuels, so it's virtually impossible to use the internet right now without the fossil fuels. So.
That was an interview with Murtaza, someone that I met on the bus in Nashville and had met before in Northampton, who's organizing Bike the Line along a pipeline in Michigan. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. Also coming up at 6 is Vinyl Countdown, the Vinyl Countdown, Wednesdays from 6 to 7. Kate Lorenz of Rusty Bell serves up a crackling mix of classic rock B-sides with occasional visits from musical guests to play records that have influenced their careers. Here, I'll play some Johnny Cash.
Watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you, because you're mine. I walk the line. As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night. And happiness I've known proves that it's right, because you're mine. I walk the line.